great.
In addition.
Good evening, everybody. I wanted to say a little bit about the Chanukah. We're still now at the end of Chanukah, and everybody grew. I mean, I definitely grew a little bit over Chanukah. But I thought everybody had enough latkes and zufganiyot and played enough dreidel that maybe we should move on into this week's parasha. If everybody saw the title, Tension in Cairo, I was going to think about speaking a little bit about current events, but then I started looking it up, but I couldn't pronounce anybody's name in there. So I figured, forget it. That's not... we'll have to go into the past tension in Cairo many, many years ago, which is this week's parasha, started in last week's parasha, already in Parashas Mikates, continuing on into this week's parasha, the tension between the brothers, and Yosef and his brothers. To start off this, starting off tonight, I wanted to just mention a point which Abshalom Shadon, a lot of the Baal Musa speak about how Chazal viewed these few parashas together between the brothers and all the machlokes back and forth with all the stories that happened, and all the, even though it was seemingly very moving experience, the whole story is a beautiful story, how the brothers didn't see in 22 years. And I remember one of my rishivas said that some guy was writing about it and saying this is the most moving story written in history. This is almost a beautiful story how he gave up to his brothers. So it reminds you of like all the moving stories that you have. Speaking about Chanukah, the story about Chanukah that there was a kid after the war. He was looking around for his father's menorah. He thought he lost his father, his mother. He lost everything in the war. He's about 10 years old. The kid David, and he goes and he searches. He finds his father's menorah in the house. He goes back to the house. They didn't let him in. He finds a soldier, one of the American soldiers. Helps him get into his house, and he finds his father. This is an ancient menorah, 200-year-old menorah, that was almost a special menorah, very noticeably different than a regular menorah. It had lions in the bottom with birds and things, a whole fancy thing. It was in the family for years. He remembers his grandfather lighting, and after his grandfather passed away, he remembers his father lighting. He thought, you know, he's got a continued tradition. He's going to keep the menorah. And so he finally got hold of it, and the American soldier, which helped him out, happened to be a Yid. And he realized that this kid doesn't have anybody, any family, doesn't have anybody to take care of him, doesn't father, no mother, it was after the war. So he decides he's going to adopt him, and he takes him back with him to America, and this kid is clutching his menorah, he takes it along with him wherever he goes. And comes the first night of Hanukkah, he lights his menorah, he's all excited, tearful, he remembers his grandfather and father anymore, he can't contain himself, he's crying the whole night, the second night, the third night. And on the fourth night of Hanukkah, he lights his menorah. Every time he lights it, he breaks down in tears. He goes up to his room, and like a half hour later, all of a sudden, there's a knock on the door. He's lighting in Brooklyn, and there's a knock on the door, and some lady is by the door, and she asks him, "Could you be fake? Could you please shut off your cell phone or at least put it on vibrate?" And she asks him, "Could you be fake? Could I take a look at this menorah? Because it seems like a different type of menorah." And she goes and she looks at it, and she's staring. He's like, "Where'd you get this menorah from?" It says we adopted this kid from Europe. And as she's talking to the family, he comes, the David comes walking down, and all of a sudden the lady turns around, she sees him, she says, starts crying, she says, "Mommy, she's David!" And the mother really was alive the whole time, and she sees the menorah, and she gets reunited with his brother, the whole place is bawling on the tears, crying, unbelievable thing. You have these stories all the time. And seeming this is what should happen when you read the story of the brothers reuniting, Yaakov coming down, and the brothers, Yosef starts crying. It's a very moving experience. For some reason, Chazal decided to give Musa Shmuzin through the whole story between the brothers and saying, the whole thing has Musa through. It says how the brothers, you should learn out this Musa and that Musa from the whole thing. And they ignore the whole emotional part of the whole story, and they're not getting all worked up with the emotions. It's what pshat? How did Chazal be able to take such a moving experience and go ahead and take such musr out of it? So Rav Shalom Shadron has two views on the matter. He says the first case, he says was a different story. Obviously, he said there was a story with when he was on the boat, he was coming back from America, and he was on a boat, and he sees the whole time in the boat there's some kid pacing back and forth in the boat. He can't get hold of control himself. He says, finally, you make a big announcement that the boat's going to dock in Eretz Yisrael, and this kid's on the holding his suitcases already, he's pacing. And they dock, and but they don't let you off. First, you have all the soldiers to come and check, make sure everything's safe, everything's good. And they're waiting over there, and the soldiers are starting to come in. And this kid's like pacing back and forth at the end of the dock, looking. All of a sudden, from the crowd, there's a whole crowd that gathered together to greet all the guests. All of a sudden, you hear a scream, Mayishala! And this kid sees, screams, Mama! And he jumps out through all the soldiers, runs down there. It was his mother that he didn't see, and he got lost during the war again. And they finally got reunited after many, many years. The whole place is crying and tearing and everything else. And then after a little while, after the whole story, everybody goes back. They get order back. Brought an order back together, and everything goes on. So Shon says, everybody saw the story. Whoever was there was very moved. Beautiful, very nice story. And he moved on with life. Say, who's the only one that didn't move on with life because of it? That changed because of it? Something happened to them because of it? He said, the kid and the mother didn't forget the story so fast. And they kept living with this story and united together forever and ever. He says, why? Because it was them. And it had to do with them. They felt that it was their life. It was something that had to do with them. So Chazal learned the story. It wasn't just the story that happened to happen to the brothers many years ago. And it's a beautiful story that we just read along and we continue on with our life. It says, Torah was their life. And therefore, every move, they lived it. It says, not only lived it, they took it as if it's like their business. He says, he was in America during the World Fair. I think there was the one in 1964 and 65 in New York. It was this huge World Fair. About 51 million people attended it over the year. It was this huge thing. It was a square mile. The whole thing was all the newest inventions that they're planning on coming, and all the newest, all the things, all the they're going to have. Instead of having their rotary phones, they're going to have digital phones on display. That how you can do it, and they're going to be able to send the paper from one side of the world to the other side of the world. My mother told me all about it. She went, and they couldn't believe it's not possible to have phones that without wires, all sorts of major inventions that were going on in the World Fair. This was a major event. They had one, I think, in the 1800s in Europe, but this was the first big, huge one in America. So there was 51, the official number was actually 51,607,307 people attended the World Fair. They were expecting actually 70 million, but they only managed to make 51 and a half, basically, give or take one or two. And Reb Shom said he was actually in America at the time, and the people that were staying there, they were all excited about it. Everybody was going. They're all going to the World Fair. That's Reb Shom, if you want to come along, he said, it's fine. You'll tell me what happened there. Said, okay, I'll stay here and learn. Kids, they come back, and they're all excited about all different technologies, which are going to happen with rocket ships and things, and all sorts of the new things. You speak to anybody in that age that was in New York. It was like the major event of the whole New York. All the latest inventions, computers the size of this room, all that type of stuff. And he said everybody was just wonderful. They were going from one booth to another booth, and everybody watching the whole time. But they said that there was a few people that didn't walk around. He says, what's the shot? Then there were some people there that would stand there by one machine the whole time for a few weeks straight, just standing by one machine the whole time. They didn't go, they weren't in other, nothing else. It was different people grouped in different places. And all they would do was stand there by one machine, standing there staring at it. So they couldn't figure out we were going around for one thing. So we saw this, one saw this, one saw that, and saw all sorts of that, things, all sorts of exciting things that are going to be invented maybe one day. There were flying cars, probably all sorts. And these guys were just standing one thing. So what's the difference? So why? So Shon says it's a push to answer. The reason why is because these guys are inventors themselves. And they're trying to figure out exactly how this thing was made and how they could go ahead and imitate it. And exactly how this was done and what happened and how it was put together. And they're standing there staring at the thing, hoping to be able to hop another point of how this was made, and therefore to be able to imitate it, because this is their business. They want to try to invent it themselves. They're trying to imitate it, trying to have their own business and imitate it. So Chazal looked at the Torah like this was the business. This is something they have to learn from me. This is something I have to live from, and this is our life. And we got to learn from this. We can't just have the story pass by. We're not just going to, okay, nice story, let's move on with life. We're going to go and work on it and see exactly what we can learn and what they took out of each story and each aspect of it. And the most famous thing that they that the that we learn how the Chazal bring down, Benish brings down, when the students said that when Yosef met up with his brother, the first thing is, Chazal say that it says that they weren't able to stand in front of him. Chazal say, woe is to us for the day of judgment. Woe is for us that when we're going to get Musa for what we've done. Says, what's the explanation? The Pashat, a lot of the Baal Musa all speak about the fact that what happened over here, the whole time Yehuda was coming and crying to him and say, listen, what's going to be with our brothers? We're going to be with our brothers. It's going to be our father. Our father is going to, as soon as he finds out that our brother is not around, the youngest brother, he's going to end up dying. He's going to have such pain and everything else. And they're pleading his case for the whole time. We can't bring it down. We could bring it down. Finally, we do bring it down. He got caught and everything else. So they're pleading his case the whole time. And what are they saying? They're saying because our poor father is going to die. And as soon as Yosef said, what does Yosef say? I need Yosef. I oida vichai. They got such musr. They got mamash musr. According to one measure, the yotzen nishmasim, they actually died from the embarrassment that they got. What was Yosef telling? What was Yosef telling? I said, I'm Yosef. Beautiful thing. They should be all excited. He said, my father's still alive. You weren't very concerned about when you were selling me. Whatever you did to me, you were all of a sudden worried about your father being sick. And I was thinking, you're really, really concerned about that? So what happened when you were selling me? How come you weren't concerned about it then? And that's what Chazal saw in the Ani Yosef Ayrinchai. Not the beautiful reunion of the brothers. He saw this point that a person could go ahead and do something and keep saying how he's righteous and he's doing the right thing, that right thing, and he has to do this thing and this must be done. And after, within his own actions, he's going to be caught saying, oh yeah, this is what you hold. You could have done it. Look over there, you held differently. The famous story was in the Tziv, and the Tziv made a big celebration when he finished one of his farm. And they asked in the Tziv, why all of a sudden, what's the big celebrations? He says, because when I was a kid, he says, I wasn't exactly the best kid. I was running around. I wasn't sitting and learning the whole time. And my father, one night I overheard my father say, listen, what's going to be with our kid? He's not holding my learning. He can't do it. So let's go. We're going to take him to the shoemaker, or the blacksmith, or whatever it is, and we'll teach him a trade. What can you do? I guess learning is just not for him. And he heard his father speaking. He ran into the room and says, no. I'm going to learn, I'm going to start learning, don't worry, I'm going to start learning. And he ended up being the Netziv. He says, imagine I wouldn't have heard this conversation. What would have happened? I would have gone, I would have been a blacksmith or a tailor, whatever it is, I mean, could have eaten, I would have been fine, and my dick, and I would have come to Shemaim, and they would have asked me, okay, very good, but where's all this farm you wrote? He says, what do you mean? I was kavei itim. I learned. I gave tzedakah. I went daven 3 times a day. I put on tefillin. A lot better than a lot of other people that do. They don't do that either. He says, yeah, but where's your sfarim? I said, what do you mean with my sfarim? And they were showing me all these sfarim that I could have written if I would have sat down and learned. And he says, so now I'm thinking back on it. He said, the big simcha that I'm making now is because I had that foresight. And look what I thought. I really could. I was able to do it. I was able to write nitziv. I was able to write all these sfarim. A lot of people limit themselves by saying, I can't do it. And afterwards, they go and they show, look, you say that you have no zitzvah, you can't sit and learn, I have no time for this, I have nothing. He said, look, you have time for other things, for other narishkeit, you do have time for. And that's the musa that the Chazal see from the meeting of the Yosef reuniting with his brothers. There's a story with the Baal Tanya. The Baal Tanya, one time there was a maggid going around, and he would give musa to everybody. And he called them over and said, listen, you give musa to everybody else and tell them how they should become better and how it should be good. He says, give me musa. I want someone, no one goes around. Tell me about Tanya was the God. No one goes around telling you about Tanya musa. Give me some musa also. They think, what are you going to tell about Tanya? You go tell Chaim Krenevsky, comes and tells you, give me some musa. What are you going to tell him? So he thinks for a second. He says, listen, okay. He says, what am I supposed to tell you? He tells him, whatever I know, you know. There's nothing that I know that you don't know. He says, whatever you don't know, I don't know myself either. But he says, the difference between the amount that I know and you know is a lot less than the difference between the amount that you know and the amount that you still have to know. And the Tal Tanya heard that and he burst out into tears. He understood, and the Muslim saying, you're right. You know everything. You're so good. But see how much more you could do. How much more there is to do. Don't just settle with the lesser amount and say, okay, this is enough. You got to push a little harder. You see a lot of times, you see people that, yeah, I don't have time for this, I don't have time for that. And then afterwards, when it comes to other things, and they find time. Baruch Hashem, we started a Sunday morning shiur. What happened until now? I don't know. People are now finding time for the Sunday morning kollel. There's time for it. So what happened before? You get people playing basketball. There's a basketball game. Maybe Sunday morning. It's very hard competition. But I don't have time, a lot of time. But somehow they found time to learn to play baseball, to play basketball. That people have time for. When it comes to other things, the person's going to come to mind and say, listen, I was busy at work all day. I was busy this, I was busy that. And what happened? They say, I couldn't have time. And then they're going to show you black and white, how you had time over here, you have time here. It's just a matter of how much where you focus here, what's important and what's not important. As soon as you focus the importance on the right things, then there's always time for more things. There's always time that you're there for, and by that, you won't, when you come to Shemayim, they're not going to be embarrassed the way the brothers were embarrassed about the fact when they say, is my father still alive? And showing themselves, look, how yourself, you could have done yourself didn't bother so much about Yaakov's worry. Now over here, you're giving a whole drush about Yaakov being worried. That's one nekuda. And the truth is, how much you give up to be able to do what you're doing, that's how much schar, that's how much chashivis gives to the thing. It says if you're willing to give up a certain amount to be able to learn a certain thing, so now to the thing that you're learning, that gives that more chashivis. So there's a story of Rabbi Yankelinsky was once in Tel Aviv, and he needed a minyan for mincha. He goes into the shul, there's nine guys. There's no minyan. He's the ninth guy. He walks in. He's learning, trying to find a shkia, is coming up, doesn't know what to do. Finally, he goes to his makolet next door, still a store. Next door, and the guy said, "Yeah, the guy, he's, and they need him for a tenter." He comes in. He said, "Listen, I can't. I have a business. I can't." So Bjorn Kulinski pulls a fast one. He says, "Listen, I have yard site. I have to kaddish." The guy didn't have yard site, but the guy got all the motion. Okay, yard site, kaddish. All of a sudden, I'm saying that's okay, fine. He comes into the store. He closes the shop, and after davening, Bjorn Kulinski davening, and he's not saying kaddish. So he tells him, "I thought you had yard site." He says, "Yeah, you're right. I didn't have yard site." Listen, whatever. How much did you lose while you were dying? I'll pay you up, which is 100 shekel, 150 shekel. He said he got lost 300 shekel, but he's not giving away the mitzvah for 300 shekel. I said, Yantzik, he said, you see, for this person, the mitzvah mincha, the whole time, for the last 15, 20 years, the guy hasn't done mincha b'sibur because he's working. He's working. He can't. But now he daven mincha b'sibur, and he was able to, he had the schus of daven mimashlam minyan. So for him now, a mincha is worth 300 shekel. And Shemayim, look at this guy, he was willing to give up 300 shekel to be able to daven mincha. He had the chashivas, 300 shekel, I guess for him was a big amount. And said, so that's the chashivas of the mitzvah. He says that whatever you give up for the mitzvah, it gives it more chashivas to be able to get more for the mitzvah, and that gives more importance to each mitzvah. That's one nekudah that we'd like to speak, that one of the things that Chazal saw was the story with the brother. But there's another very amazing point which Shlomo Chadron speaks about. Because there's a lot of kashas. There's a lot of kashas on this whole story. He wants to know, says, we're starting with last week's parasha. What was this whole thing about Yosef putting money inside the bag? Okay, he didn't want to take money from his brothers. Why is he putting the money inside the bag? What was he trying to gain from that? That wasn't like part of the plot. The Torah keeps talking about the fact they found, they took out, one took a person talked about it, and he found his money. They went back all the way to the Tishin. They found their money. They're all nervous, giving back the money. What's this whole money thing? So, aside the point, I got a shot that one time, one person wants to say that the whole reason why Yosef was trying to get all the money down to Mitzrayim was in order when Klai Yisrael leaves, they should have a lot of business Mitzrayim. They should have V'acha Ken Yoytzi Berchush Gadol, that Kesh Baruch Hu promised Avram that when they leave Mitzrayim, they can leave Berchush Gadol. So he was trying to get the more money than there was, the more Rechush Gadol, he could keep up with Rechush Gadol. I said, that was all the money from other people. The money that's theirs anyways, so there's no reason to have it down there. They don't need that money because anyways, there it's for the Rechush Gadol. But that's it. He said, what's the Torah making such a big deal about this whole money? And another very powerful question he asked, Yosef sends his son to go chase after, he puts the silver cup inside the bag, and he goes and he chases after him. He tells him, listen, what are you doing? Why did you bring it back? Or, so he wants to know, what's the big deal? Why don't they say, they know the whole thing was made up. They found their money inside their bags. They know the whole thing has been, this person's been like driving them crazy, making up stories from the beginning to the whole thing, Miraglim and everything else. So he said, oh, what's the big deal? Just pick up and say, I'm sorry, have a good day. Kultuv, we're going back to your slime. So they go ahead and they follow him back to Mitzrayim. What's the deal? They say, I'm very happy to see you. They weren't like scared of any army starting up with them or robbing. They say, what's the deal? They say, have a nice day. Here's your Becher back. Kultuv. What was the whole, why are they going back? And he brings down a Medrash, Yalkut Shemoyni. Part of it is brought down in the Das Ken and Baal Tosfos, actually. But he brings down, it says that the Pasuk brings down, Heim Yotzu is a ir lo yechiku. They left the city, they did not go very far. But Yosef Omar Shah basic Kuru Doif Achandoshim. Yosef says the Pasuk, they didn't go very far. And he told this the person that's in charge of his house to go chase after the people. We sacked him, revert him, and go catch up to him. Lam Shalom, then why did you pay a bag? It was good. So the Medrash says, Omar, he tells him, Yarchiku min ha'ir, afilu mil, afod, if they go far from the city, even 1 mil, ain ko beri yechoy lachzirim. No bear, no creation could come and bring them back. Kum redoif achanoshim bo'oit she'emas krach aleim. While the fear of the city is still on them, go chase them. So if they dare go even 1 mil away from the city, when they don't have the fear of the city, no way of getting them back. You're not getting them back. There's no creation in the world like to get them to come back. So, what's this Ema Seir? What do you mean? What are they scared of? They're here they come back. They're ready to destroy the home of Mitzrayim. And here he's coming with one little guy comes chasing after them and says, come back. You say, okay, fine. Let's come back. Well, we're fine. We're good. We're going to be slaves. Kill us. The whole shebang. He says, what's pshat in this, in the whole back and forth? And he asks one more question. He says that also the Gemara brings down that there's a machloikis if Yosef did the right thing by telling everybody. Yosef told everybody to leave. And what he told, when he said on the Yosef, when he revealed himself to his brothers, he told everybody to leave. He says, machloikis if he did the right thing or not. And what she says, of course, we're not choshed that the brothers are going to kill him. There's no way that the brother, even though they were ready to kill him, there's no one there. They could just kill him. There's no army. There's no anybody around. Said, there's no problem. Said, why wasn't he scared? Why wasn't he scared? Oh, Yehuda's going around. The Midrashim bring down that he hears it come through his metals, the armor, and he's chasing around and throwing things up and smashing them on the floor. And there was 500, I think, big soldiers came around. He gave one roar and their heads turned around and they stayed turned around for the rest of their life. Scary stuff was going on there. And he says, he's fine. He's calm. He's not getting nervous. At the end, he gets a little nervous, tells everybody to leave. And for some reason, he's not scared to be alone with them. And he says unto Yosef, why wasn't he scared? What was it's extremely dangerous situation he was in. A lot of tension in Cairo there. So, Reb Shalom says that Yosef was working, was playing with their Midas Hayashlus. He said he was playing, he knew that as long as he's being straight, there was some sort of accusation against them. There is nothing in their power that they could physically do. They won't be able to do it. Said they had such control over themselves that if it's not 100% yashrus, it's not straight exactly what they're doing, there's no way that they're doing it. There's nothing they're going to do. He said Yosef wanted to make sure that they come back to Mitzrayim. How are they going to make sure that they come back? They left it then. They know this guy's driving them nuts and he's making them a sugar. He says, forget it. Why are they coming back? So John brings down the story. It was Briskerov. One time wanted to mail something. He wanted to make sure something was for sure mailed. He wanted to make sure it was done. He wanted to send someone to the post office. So he wanted to make sure that it was mailed. So he does this. A stamp was a ruble or 2 rubles, whatever it was, a few change. And he pulls out like a 100-ruble note. And he says, okay, here's, please go mail the letter. So the guy said, no, 100 rubles, and then she didn't get all the change from the post. I think. So don't worry, I'll pay for it, it's fine, don't worry about it. Like, here, keep your ruble, I'll take care of the 2 rubles, whatever it is. So he says, no. He says, I want to make sure that you do it. I know if I give you a 100 ruble note, you're going to have to come back to me with the change. So therefore, I'm making sure that I'm giving you the 100 ruble note on purpose to make sure that you're coming back to me and make sure that you did your job. He says, Yosef wanted to make sure they're coming back. And as long as there was something that wasn't straight. They can't leave a city, have the money in their hands, even though, okay, the mistake, they didn't know exactly why, how, and what, and where how the money got in there. But it wasn't Yashus to take money, take food, and still keep the money. So they had to come back. Yosef knew they were coming back. There's no way out of it. And this that Yosef sent the guy, his son, and told him that as long as there's Ema Seir Olam, There's no, they're going to come back. But after that, there's no way they're coming back. See, because as long as they're in the city, and he's coming, his son's coming, and said, listen, you stole my father's becher, the king's becher, the king's goblet, and the silver goblet, and it looks funny. You're in the city, you caught with the silver becher there, and you're just running away from the city. It just says a bunch of robbers. That's not straight. You can't do something like that. So if they're out of the city and everybody knows, they know themselves and no one sees it, the whole situation, it's okay. They know the whole thing is funny. It doesn't look like they're running away as robbers. They just, someone comes and has false accusation of them, they knock him out and say, here's your becher, go home. He says, but as long as the aim of the city, it still looks as if that there's something funny here. They had a good accusation, had a good complaint on him. We have your becher. Don't run away like a bunch of robbers. Get back the thing and run away. That's not Yashrus. They had to come back. They had no choice. It's not Yashrus if they don't come back. And then as long as he had a complaint, a right complaint about them, and as long as he was saying, he took my becher, the back and forth, he wasn't scared that Yehuda is going to do anything to him. Because it's going to look funny. That Yehuda, they come, I have a complaint about you, you did something wrong, and I go and chop off your head. It's just not right. It's not Yashrus. And Yehuda couldn't do it. He knew that Yehuda is not going to be able to do it if it's not Yashrus. And therefore he wasn't scared. Only at the end, when Yehuda, he already answered up all his complaints and explained to him why you're not really making too much sense. And I'm better than you and that I can do a much better job and all the conversation back and forth. So then he got nervous. He felt he had to reveal himself to his brothers and tell him on Yosef. So what did he do? He goes in and says, listen, I have something else to tell you. I want to speak to you privately. As soon as he says that, Yehuda can't kill him now. Listen, we were back and forth, but now he still has something else. He has new evidence. He has something else to complain about. He has something else to say. And he wants to speak to you privately. To go ahead and kill him after I told you that I have something new to say and you didn't hear me out? So you can't do that. That's not Yashrus. That's not straight. That's crooked. To go ahead and kill him then. Therefore, Yosef was not scared at all to go ahead and be in private with his brothers while they're all petrified. Because everybody knows they wouldn't be able to do it because it would look very funny. It wouldn't look like a nice thing to do. Now, you had someone come and tell you, listen, I have something private I want to tell you. Let's take this private. I'm going to speak to you then. And then go ahead and kill it. This looks funny. It wouldn't be right. And therefore, he wasn't scared at all that something's going to happen. And this power of being full control, the Medrash calls them malachim. This is what Yehuda and Yosef, both of them, this Yosef realizing that he had this, and Yehuda himself was the power of malachim. The Medrash brings down the pasuk. It says, "Kineh malachim niyodu over yach." The kings stood together and they were together. It says, "Who's these malachim?" It says, "This is Yosef and Yehuda." And the brothers stood there in awe, and he said, "Listen, the two kings are fighting with each other. We're not getting involved. We're not going to." Says, let the one king deal with the other king. Says, what does he mean, king? He said, what does he mean? Yehuda was kicked off. He lost his job at the time. He was out of business. He wasn't the king anymore. He was sent away. What does he mean, the king? They explain there's two types of kings. The king, the only reason why he's a king is because he has a nation that he has and he runs. And really, he's a slave because without the nation, ein melech l'olam. Without the nation, he's not a king. So really, he needs his nation as much as they need him. So he's a king on top of them, but he's just basically a ruler. Someone's melech ha'atzman himself. He himself is in control of himself, and he's in full control. And that we found by Yehuda when he's able to be moida, when he's able to admit to the story with Tamar, which was a gvur beyond. And nobody would have known if he wouldn't have admitted. Tamar would have gotten killed, and nobody would have found that. Actually, Rosh Hashanah has a whole different approach on that whole thing. He says, well, how can he say that? What's the big deal, really? Like, see, who'd admit it? Right? He's going to let three people get killed. It was twins and they were her. So it's like, duh, of course you can admit it. I'm saying, you don't have to be a bigot sadik to go ahead and not. If he wouldn't have done it, if he wouldn't have admitted it, we're going to Russia. Saying, let someone get killed because you don't want to be embarrassed. So Rosh Hashanah says, of course, that's not. He wasn't going to let them get killed. That wasn't the thing. Yehuda was a big lamdan. Says he would have said, listen, new evidence came, there's new aegis and rayas and zach, and it would have made up a gan salumdus of how to figure out. He said, no, we can't exactly, we have to reevaluate the whole case. And he would have come up with alumdus, why? No, she's not chaimisa, sabi chazaka, and rayav, and saying that, he's not chaimisa, and of course, he wasn't willing to kill her. So well, he could have gotten out of it with that, he couldn't make sure that she doesn't get killed. But no, the gvur of Yehuda was that even though he could have gotten out of nothing, whatever, no one would have known, it would have been fine, he didn't have to admit it. But no, emes is that I did it, not start making up other lumnuses. He says, me manage, for me. And that's called being in control yourself. Baal Shem Tov says, it says, emes me'eretz tzitzmach. Emes grows from the ground. So yes, listen. Emes grows from the ground. So what's the big deal? Why is emes? It'd be so hard to get emes. Emes, the world is full of sheker. It's growing from the ground. He says, the problem is, you have to bend down to pick it up. So that's the problem with emes. And Yehuda, you're right, he could have gotten out of it in that same, but emes was emes, and therefore he was going to go, and no matter what, he was in full control, no matter what is going to happen, and that's the meat of Malchus, that he's totally governed by what's the right thing to do. There's nothing else controlling him besides what's the right thing to do. But the truth is, for us, that's the Shvatim. The Shvatim were totally, everything they were Malchus, they were totally governed. Every move, every aspect that they did was according to what's right and what's wrong. So what do we do? What does that have to do with us? Okay, it's right. We should be taka, be straight in every move and aspect. We shouldn't be able to do something that's not right. It shouldn't be possible for us to do something like that. But Lamaish, so what do? We're not like that. We don't have it so hard to do things which are not exactly the proper thing. So actually, Rabbi Dodo was touched on this when he was speaking. He says, we have to make ourselves mukhak. We have to make ourselves that we have no choice. I saw a story with the Heilige Reb Zisha. Reb Zisha was a Talmud, I think, of Melech, maybe? Yeah? Who was Reb Zisha Talmud of?
He was a brother.
So who was the Talmud of?
The
Mezitcha Magid. The kids say he was learning by Mezitcha Magid, and he had a family somewhere further away. And the Mezitcha Magid called him up and said, listen, your daughter is getting of age and she needs to get married. And you've been sitting your whole life, you don't have a penny to your name. Here's 300 ruble, whatever it is, enough amount to be able to give a money to marry off your daughter. Here's 300 ruble, go ahead, marry off your wedding, go back to your town and marry off, you find a shidduch for your daughter and marry her off. Okay, Rebbe says, he's out of here. So he goes on his way, he stops in one place, and all of a sudden he hears crying coming out of one of a room. He goes to check out what it is. He says, what happened? He says, what happened was there was a Yosema that was supposed to get married, and her mother, Amona, saved up money the whole time, 300 ruble to be able to marry her off. And they come to get the money, and the money's not there, and the chazan's not walking down the aisle without the money. And the mother's crying, the daughter's crying, it's a terrible thing. It's shreklach. So he comes in and asks, terrible. He said, really? He comes in and he says, I found the money. So he said, really, 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 unbelievable. So he goes, so where's the money? He says, I have it in my hotel room. I don't have it here. I don't carry it along with me. He said, but just to make sure that I got the right thing, he said, tell me exactly what type of bills. How many tens, how many fives, how many hundreds, how many things. Exactly what the bills say. They tell him exactly this is how much it was, this and this coins. And of course, as soon as he gets back to the hotel, he runs to the money changer, divides it up exactly into that amount of money, and he runs to the chasen hall, and they start clapping, and Novi came, it's unbelievable, this is the most amazing thing. Everybody's all excited, dancing around him. And he's about to give him the money, and he says, it's very nice, but you have to pay me for Sechar Tircha. I found the money, you got to pay me for this. It's not free. He's looking like crazy. Pay you. It's a mitzvah. Shabbos Tavei. He just saved the whole chasen. Starts screaming. What are you doing? Finally, one of the uncles goes to the side and says, listen, okay, how much do you want? They give a ruble, 2 rubles, 3 rubles? No, I want 25 rubles. Like craziness, start cursing him. Yeah, so finally, one person says, okay, fine, let's just go to the Rav, and we'll just go. We'll take him to the Rav and see what happens. They take him to the Rav. Rav says, you're sugaring it to 25 rubles to me. There ain't no way. They grab the money from him and says, get out of here. And he's sent away in his embarrassment. Gets there. A few weeks later, his Rebbe, the Mezitcha Magid, you see? His Rebbe, he goes to this town, and he meets up with this Rav, and he tells him, what type of Talmidim do you have? This guy, give him what he wanted, money to be able to pay up the state. Well, what was he doing? What was he thinking? So, he knows that his Talmud is a big tzaddik, and he thinks, right? In fact, what happened? So he finally, when he calls in, next time he sees Mezitcha, he calls him and he says, okay, Mezitcha, what happened? Okay, I know you gave away the money, that was your money, that I understand. Okay, fine. But Mona, Yisayma, it was the money I gave you, fine, you had no choice. I said, but what was the pshat that you wanted to take Schar Tircha? He says, I'll tell you what happened. He says, when I came into that wedding, as soon as I agreed to give that money, all of a sudden, Yitzhak came along and says, Mezitcha, Mona, you're a good guy. Not bad. Giving away all that money that you just gave away, that's pretty good. I knocked him away. And as I went and I switched around the money to make sure everybody realizes that nobody should realize that it was me really, Sir again came along and like said, Disha, not bad. You're pretty good. You're a good lador. You're just tickling. I'm saying, what are these stories? Maybe I'll write a book about you. But And but he knocked him out. Finally, we came to the chasen, and everybody's like, this little young dog, we're dancing around him. He says, I couldn't do it anymore. I said, I couldn't. It was getting to me. You start coming here, rich, consider Ashkabag, and because Tzaddik, no, we're all nowhere such since the time of Rachel, he made to give away some money. There wasn't such a day because, like, Tzaddik, like you. I couldn't do it anymore. So I had no choice. And I went and I started making up the story that I want 25 ruble. And as soon as that happened, all of a sudden, all the Tzaddik and the Zidavas, they got bushes and chufas, and they got kicked out, spit them in your face, and they kicked me out. And Baruch Hashem, I got rid of the Yetzer Hara. A person has to make himself a Baruch. You don't have to go that far. But a person has to make himself that he has no choice, that this is the you put yourself in the position, you commit to do something, you go, you tell Chavrus, okay, I'm going to learn with you this and this time. So now you're committed. So even though I can't, I have a hard time controlling it, I can't find myself. But at least you put yourself in a position which you have no choice, and now you have to do what the right thing is. So even if you don't have full control over yourself, but you put yourself in a situation when you have your state of mind is not at the Nisayon, that when the Nisayon will come about, you'll be mukhrach, you'll be forced, you have no choice but to do the right thing. And if you do that and you try to grow, whenever you have a Nisayon, you grow much bigger and bigger. And it makes your life a lot you're a lot stronger. And the next time you have a Nisayon, you'll have a much easier time. I know the mashal I heard from Rabbi Waxman. He said by Hurricane Sandy, last time around, there was in Lakewood, there was a set of townhouses. Whoever in Lakewood, there was house, 10 houses which were made exact same thing. Each one has exact same, the bombers punked the, maybe different colored doors, but more than that, they're all exactly the same thing. And there was, the architect did exactly, built the tree in each one exactly the same spot in front of the houses. And B'kitzer Maisa, by Hurricane Sandy, the hurricane came on this block, says five of the trees went knocked down, and the other five weren't knocked down. And he was baffled. It wasn't so much, like, he didn't really, it wasn't so much secured by a tree, it all was insured and it was fine. But the problem, he went to, like, what happened here? Why five of the trees were knocked down and five of the trees weren't knocked down? So he hired architects and engineers and scientists. After major investigation, he realized that the five trees that were knocked down, they put in a sprinkler system into the grass, and the five that weren't down didn't put a sprinkler system. He says, what's Pshat? He says, the five trees that had the sprinkler system, said they kept, water kept coming, and they had no reason to be able to grow the roots any deeper. Said the five trees that didn't have a sprinkler system, they had no choice but to make the roots go deeper and deeper into the ground until they find some source of water. They didn't have water higher up. They had to grow the roots into the ground deeper and deeper to be able to find some water over there. They were mukh, they're forced to get bigger and bigger. Says, but the other trees, they had water right on top. The sprinkler kept draining them. There was no reason. Therefore, the wind came down and it knocked them right over. Says, the person keeps making himself mukh, he makes him that he has no choice. He has no choice but to do the right thing. So even though he's forced to do it, but his roots keep growing and grow bigger and bigger and deeper into the ground. And then when that wind comes, it taka won't daken down. Shtaka bizoyche, to be able to get from that, but be forced to do the right thing, then eventually make it that we have no choice, and our every aspect and everything that we do is not going to be governed according to what's right and what's wrong.